Good morning, everybody. What I want to do today is to try to explain from the point of view of the United Kingdom how the government and the nuclear authorities are approaching handling the problem of nuclear decommissioning. But before I do that, I want to give you an apology for not having prepared the promised PowerPoint presentation. I think there's a good reason for it, which I shall tell you. Which is about 10 days ago, there was an announcement by the British government that there had been a complaint by the families of former workers of several nuclear plants, including Sellafield, the big reprocessing plant, which has taken some of Sweden's spent fuel. The families complained that they... Their husbands mostly, or sometimes their brothers and sons, they had discovered that some of their organs had been taken by the medical authorities for research purposes because they wanted to investigate the implications of having been exposed to radiation during time working in the nuclear sector. it wasn't a surprise that there had been examination of the organs of nuclear workers, but the problem was they hadn't informed the families that they had removed organs from the dead bodies and remove tissues. And that caused a big furore in Britain 10 days ago. And as a result of that, I had to act very fast because 5 years ago I did some research in the National Archives of the British official papers where the Atomic Energy Authority, which is the main body that's done research and development in the United Kingdom since the early part of the 1950s, so it's 50 years of research, I'd put their research papers into the National Archive, and I did this research 5 years ago and discovered that they had deposited papers about radiation experiments that they had been conducting. And some of these experiments described some rather, I would describe as unethical approaches to research. And afterwards, not now, I'm happy to share with anybody who's interested in that aspect of the issue. Some of the kind of unethical research that was conducted in the 1950s and 1960s in the United Kingdom. Well, what I will do as an opener to my presentation is I'll just read you an extract from what was publicly reported to the first International Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Nuclear Energy held in Geneva under the auspices of the United Nations in 1958. There was a paper presented by a health physicist who was then working at Sellafield. And he was describing some experiments that had been conducted at Sellafield in the 1950s. And I'll quote, he said, and this is a direct quote, the preliminary studies had concluded no discharges of radioactivity because it was recognized that such discharges were unlikely to produce useful experimental results unless they were continued for some months. And he went on to say that by 1952, however, it was possible to make such regular discharges from windscale, and it was decided to combine these with a detailed monitoring program to form a planned experiment. And then he added, when there was some questioning from the floor, the following comment. The sea has always been regarded by coastal seafaring people as the ideal place for dumping their waste. And this is, of course, a very reasonable and proper attitude. Clearly, international fishing interests have to be protected, but apart from this possible international problem, the administrative control of the coastal disposal of radioactive waste is a national or even a local responsibility. Now, it's in that context, of that mindset, that outlook on the world, that you can understand that 5 to 6 years later, that the same people were in charge of that kind of deliberate experiment, the discharge of radioactive waste to the Irish Sea, thought it was also appropriate to do deliberate experiments on their workforce. And I read in the newspaper online this morning that the British minister in charge of this investigation as to what happened 40 years ago, he's begun to realize it wasn't just one plant in the UK where they were doing research. He's now opened up the investigation to four nuclear facilities in the United Kingdom, not just Sellafield. And my prediction is it'll be a lot more than four facilities by the time they finish their research. So that's why you don't have a PowerPoint presentation, because I was doing research into this. And as I say, I have here this is the project proposal from 1962, describing as to how they would do these experiments, who they would bring in as so-called volunteers, what the legal consequences would be if anybody were to make a legal claim afterwards, which is what we're now going to find out for 40 years later. And interestingly, there's also a media management strategy set out in the document. Should this information become public in the wrong way, what kind of story are they going to tell the public about this? And I thought that was very interesting, because our current government in the United Kingdom has been criticized very strongly for what we call in English spinning. That is putting the best angle on your story to the public. And I think this is a very early example of the nuclear industry spinning their story to the public. And I just say one footnote to that story. The man whose research I quoted, who told those stories to that international conference in Geneva in 1958, his name was Dr. John Dunster. Dr. Dunster was so admired by the government that he subsequently was promoted to become the head of the National Radiological Protection Board, and was in charge of the radiation protection standards in the United Kingdom for 2 decades. So it gives you an insight into the kind of mindset the people who brought this industry forward and now created this very massive legacy of radioactive waste and buildings which need to be decommissioned. And that's why I'm now going to move on to decommissioning. You have my personal background in the notes in your conference pack. The only two things I would add to it is I was also involved in an NGO-based non-proliferation consultancy agency back in the 1970s and 1980s. And I still retain an interest in nuclear security and nuclear proliferation. So I'll now move on to the historical background of the decommissioning program. I don't know if you can read that, but that's from 15 years ago, but it gives you an insight into some of the humor to do with radiation experiments at Sellafield. United Kingdom's got 60 years of radioactively contaminated buildings, radioactively contaminated land, and also what we normally call radioactive waste to be dealt with. This is spread over about 20 sites across the United Kingdom. There's several in Scotland, but most of them are in England, and there are 2 in Wales. And as far as I've discovered, there aren't any in Northern Ireland, but you never know. The most important facilities, the 2 original research and production facilities, Harwell, which was near Oxford in south of England, which was established in the late 1940s, it's got a lot of research laboratories there, which we use originally for commercial R&D, and about 20 miles to the south of it was the military equivalent at Aldermaston, where we made the nuclear warheads and still do. Of course, the other one is the internationally notorious Sellafield, which interestingly started off being called Sellafield. That was the name of the field. It then became Windscale when they had 2 different parts to the site. One was called the Windscale Works and one was called the Calder Works, which was the plutonium production reactors. And then when the site then became known as Windscale, and then when it had an accident and got some bad reputation, they changed the name to Sellafield in the mid-1970s. And then they had a series of accidents at Sellafield, and then they didn't know what to do to change the name again or go back to a new name. Anyway, the problem is everybody now recognizes it's a major radioactive hazard. And I'll just give you one example taken from the official document of the body created to handle the decommissioning in the UK, which is called the Nuclear Decommissioning authority. I put some copies of this on the tables at the back for those who are very interested. And for those of you who want to go to their website, it's very easy. It's www.nda.gov.uk. In their official document, they set out site by site the quantities of waste they calculated on each site, and they make a judgment as to what, how each site has different kinds of difficulties to manage. Just to give you an indication where the major problem is, it's at Sellafield, as you might guess. And they've calculated at the moment they have 20 million cubic meters of radioactively contaminated and toxically contaminated soil at Sellafield. And the total bill they've calculated so far that's going to cost to clean up all of the sites in the United Kingdom, the most recent official figure is £56 billion, which is what, about 90 billion euros, and about 100, right now it's about 115 billion US dollars. That's the official figure. I think the real figure is more likely to be double that, partly because all official nuclear calculations underestimate the cost, and also we know that they haven't factored into it the military decommissioning costs. And these sites are joint military and civilian, so there's going to be a military component to that. So you're talking in a ballpark figure of, you know, well in excess of 200 billion US dollars. And I suspect the numbers will go up. Now, to deal with this problem, the government decided that as most of the activities were carried out by companies which are owned by the taxpayers, the so-called public corporations, then the cleanup costs were going to fall upon the present-day and future taxpayers. So the government put to the Parliament a bill called the Energy Bill, became the 2004 Energy Act. And in this act, the government created an agency to manage the cleanup. In the bill that went before Parliament, they called it the Liabilities Management Agency. But by the time it became law in the Energy Act, they changed the name. So the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority. I always preferred the first one myself. I always thought that emphasizing the liabilities was important. But the nuclear industry didn't like that, so they put pressure on the drafters of the bill and changed it into Nuclear Decommissioning Authority. Nevertheless, the mission is the same. But there is a big problem with the way in which they set up this authority. If I go back to my titles of the sections, I'm not going to talk about the physical processes of managing decommissioning, the dismantling of buildings, the isolation of hot areas using remote-controlled cutting technologies, requirements for packaging different kinds of waste in different kinds of ways. All of these are absolutely essential, but I want to talk about the policy process and the political implications of it, because I actually think that from the point of view of activists and campaigners, that's where we can have our effect. We're not going to be involved ultimately in advising on the technical solutions to a problem. So let me just give you the big political problem, the way that this Nuclear Decommissioning Authority was set up. They knew it was going to cost a very large amount of money. They didn't want to make it clear to the taxpayers that they're going to have to pay all of this money. So that they came up with an ingenious solution, except that you'll see the flaw in it. The ingenious solution was, we'll put into the operation of the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority the existing waste creators, that is, the nuclear power plants owned by the public sector British Nuclear Fuels, and the nuclear fuel cycle processing plants owned by British Nuclear Fuels. They will all become part of the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority. Now, you can see there's a flaw in this, because what they've now done is they've put under the management authority of a decommissioning agency nuclear facilities that are actually creating the problem that they're mission to deal with. And the reason why they did this was they wanted to try to recover some of the revenue they predicted would come from the nuclear operation of these nuclear plants. Now, the key one was going to be the Thorpe reprocessing plant at Sellafield, which those in the audience who are Swedish will know was one of the places where Sweden sent some of its spent fuel in the 1970s and was quite controversial in terms of whether or not the plutonium that was reprocessed should come back in the form of MOX fuel. The big flaw in the idea was they didn't listen to those of us like myself who suggested this was going to be a very bad idea, because if you rely upon unreliable nuclear operators to earn revenue for a publicly important process to decommission facilities, you'll end up with a financial shortfall. And that's exactly what's happened, because very shortly after they created the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority, the Thorpe plant had an accident, which BNFL, the operators, didn't actually cover up. They weren't even good enough to do that. They didn't actually find it. So they continued to operate the plant for 9 months, not knowing they'd had an accident. They only discovered the accident when another part of the control authorities, the security safeguards people, discovered that the measurement of the nuclear materials going into the plant at the beginning was very different from the measurements when it came out at the other end. And as any of you who followed the issue of nuclear security and nuclear safeguards, once you find that there's a discrepancy, a difference between the input and the output, which is larger than a certain amount, that triggers an investigation. In case of plutonium, the significant quantity is 5 to 8 kilograms. Well, they lost 200 kilograms, and when the security authorities found that this was missing, they went to check what went on, and they found out there had been a small leak, which became a bigger leak, which became a bigger leak, which became a breach, and all of this plutonium liquid went into a tank, and then they had to close the plant down. And that was now nearly 3 years ago. The plant was shut down 2 years ago. It hasn't reopened. The safety authorities have given 49 specific requirements to reopen it. And in the meantime, all the money they should have been raising from running that plant to pay for part of the decommissioning hasn't been coming in, and they have a financial crisis. And this is in the first 3 years of operating the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority. So you can see that it's a very bad project, a very bad plan, based on a very bad financial basis. And it's all because the government listened to the nuclear industry, who said this is the way to pay for it, and ignored all the environmentalists and academics and others who told them that was a very bad way to do it. So I've explained to you how they've mismanaged the decommissioning program, that's point four. How they can't pay for it, that's point five. The other atomic liabilities, of course, are all the other radioactive waste problems that they have. Now, I'm not going to discuss that in detail, but explain to you one policy issue. After a three-year process of consulting the people in a very good process, which some of you may know about, called the Quorum Process, Committee on Radioactive Waste Management, extremely good process, where they engaged people across the United Kingdom over a three-year period, holding local, regional, national meetings. They held online conversations. They produced endless reports, and it was all published online in a brilliant demonstration of open publication. At the end of that process, they came to the conclusion that there ought to be some form of underground final disposal of nuclear waste, which you could have predicted from the beginning. The point was that they brought the people along with the idea. At the end of that, it was recommended that the government create an agency to manage the conclusions of the three-year investigation. Well, what the government decided to do was to incorporate the existing body called NIREX, which was set up and run by the nuclear industry. NIREX stands for Nuclear Industry Radioactive Waste Executive. They incorporated NIREX into the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority. So the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority now is not only in charge of dismantling buildings, cleaning up radioactively contaminated soil, and finding a way of packaging it, but also they're now in charge of radioactive waste management as well. So they have a bigger mission than the one they had before. And I want to make one other point to do with nuclear security, and then I'll bring my remarks to a close. I know that we're then going to go into the next one, and I can answer any questions after the next session. The Nuclear Decommissioning Authority has also set up a way of engaging with it, what it calls its stakeholders. And it has a stakeholder dialogue, which has now been running for 2 years. And one of the things it has done in the stakeholder dialogue is to set up some issue groups. One is dealing with radioactive waste, and the other one is dealing with nuclear materials. And the nuclear materials one I'm a member of, and the reason why I think it's interesting is that they're going to have to make a policy decision. Is are the nuclear materials, such as reprocessed plutonium in store, going to be regarded as an energy asset for the future, or is it going to be regarded as radioactive waste? It's an energy asset. It goes into the positive side of the balance sheet. If it's a liability, of course, it becomes another cost, and that cost of $200 billion plus dollars goes even higher. Now, the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority has established a number of projects which include bringing in external industry-based consultants. This is one of the studies that they produced in here, which is very technical. I'll just give you one overhead from one of the reports. It shows you the kind of complexity that they've gone into. I'm not sure what I personally find is helpful, but you might find it interesting. This is one of the organograms that they've decided to put to help explain to those of us who are trying to follow the debate what they're planning to do with the nuclear materials. And we spent many hours in these meetings trying to actually disentangle this web of flowcharts and different nuclear materials, different forms of uranium, different types of waste, and so on. I mean, in the end, that probably is true. That is the kind of thing they are going to have to deal with. But the most interesting thing is the politics of it. How are they going to define what these products eventually are going to be used? Are they going to be liabilities or are they going to be assets? And that's the key thing. Because if they become assets, that sets in trigger a whole new sequence of plutonium fuel fabrication, plutonium fuel movement, reinvigoration of certain parts of the nuclear industry. And, of course, for those who are very concerned about the movement of nuclear materials, a large-scale movement of nuclear weapons, usable nuclear materials. And from a personal point of view, that's the main thing I'm concerned about. Any solution to a decommissioning problem, which requires you to earn revenue to pay for the decommissioning, which is based on the international commerce in nuclear explosive materials, to me is the ultimate insanity. But that is the view that our government has as a solution. I'll just read you one very short quote from a report from the British Parliament, which is the director of the Office of Civil Nuclear Security, who gave testimony about just over a year ago to the Committee of Parliament. Actually, I don't have it in front of me, but I can tell you what he said. He basically said that As a nuclear security policing body, should the British government decide to expand the nuclear sector by building more reactors, expand the nuclear sector by having more movements of nuclear fuel, and be in the process of dismantling current nuclear facilities and transferring packaged nuclear waste from different facilities around the United Kingdom, 20 different sites, to one centralized location, then he didn't have the personnel to monitor that process in terms of security. If you think about it, you're going to have to increase many fold the number of movements by truck, by train. If it's by truck, you have to vet all the drivers. Because you only need one driver to not take that material to its destination, but to disappear. and you don't know what they're going to do with that material. And should that driver disappear and then reappear in downtown city somewhere with an explosive pack under the truck and blow it up, then you have a dirty bomb and a radiation contamination incident that will cost, again, millions and millions and millions of euros, millions and millions of dollars, and make centers of towns, even if it didn't kill a lot of people, make it economically unusable for centuries. So we're now in a situation where we're planning to expand the nuclear industry in terms of reactors, possibly expand the movements of nuclear fuels, including nuclear explosive materials and plutonium, and set off on a huge project of dismantling existing facilities to make room for the new reactors and move hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tons of radioactively contaminated materials around the country with a force of transportation where they can't vet the drivers. So if you just think about all of that together, you know, you've got, if you wanted to sit down and plan the ultimate nuclear nightmare, well, they've just managed to do that by a series of brilliant bad decisions. So I'd like to end my remarks with, just for those of you who weren't happy with that one, there's another one as well. This is the transportation one. I'd like to end my remarks by saying that I think in the United Kingdom we've got a model that everybody should take note of. And at just about every decision level where they've made a decision, my recommendation would be other countries should do the exact opposite. Because if we go ahead in this program that our government has decided is the best way to decommission our facilities, I think we're headed for what I would call an atomic Armageddon. And that's why I titled my talk, We Need to Reprocess Nuclear Thinking. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, I wasn't aware that I was supposed to be the one doing this, but I would like to thank you, David, and I'd also like to ask a simple question. Is there anyone who understands that flowchart? In your discussions, is there anyone who could say, yes, it's this way, that way, that way, and that way? Or is it just the way it looked?
No, I think what you have to do is you have to take a particular nuclear material and then you have to say, what is its character? What is the way we would approach managing it? And then you follow that particular one through. So though it looks extremely complicated because it's all put on the same diagram, you can actually disaggregate it to a different kind of nuclear material and follow it through. So I put that up there because it always has the same result. People look at it and laugh, and I think it's a good one to put up.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Let's see. I didn't give you the book.
Are there any questions?
Okay. There are questions. Just a sec.
Hi, David. You put the question as to whether the material could be considered a resource or a waste, as if this were some kind of debate. Isn't it obvious to all involved that it will be considered a resource? I mean, what is going to prevent it from being declared a resource? That's my first question. And my second question is, you referred to the radioactive effluent into the Irish Sea as an experiment, but that implies that there's some kind of interest in following up on whatever the results might be. But I don't believe it's an experiment in that sense. You know, it's like saying these atomic soldiers were guinea pigs. That implies that you're going to study what the results are. Is it an experiment in any sense of the word, or isn't it just a way of dumping the waste and not following up, not studying it? Those are my two questions.
On the issue of whether the nuclear materials can be regarded as an asset or a waste, I think there is a genuine debate over that. On the issue of plutonium, you know, the nuclear industry at the moment, because they're looking at the kind of high rises in uranium prices we saw yesterday presented, means that they're looking around for competitive ways of producing nuclear fuel other than using freshly mined uranium. The Nuclear Decommissioning Authority have been advised by one of their consultants that although you can't technically recycle, reprocess the uranium, from their point of view, it's too contaminated to chemically clean up. So therefore, they regard it now themselves as a liability, not as an asset. But you could use it as a fuel if you wanted to, but you'd have to invest in the process to decontaminate it chemically and radiochemically from the contaminants. So I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that they're going... Well, certainly, on terms of reprocessed uranium, I think they've already made a policy decision not to access that. They would prefer to buy new fuel on the uranium market. In terms of plutonium, there's a big debate within the nuclear industry. Some people think that going into the MOX plutonium fuels market is a good idea. Other ones look at the operating record of reactors in Japan and in France and say, well, no, that's not so clever. Maybe we shouldn't go down that route. Other ones hark back to the great white hope of the nuclear industry back from the 1960s of let's go down the fast reactor route. You know, I don't think it's an obvious conclusion. I think it's a debate. And I think we've got a possibility of dissuading those who think that a plutonium-fueled future is a good idea. Particularly if we continue to, I think, raise the specter, the legitimate specter of Western governments, all of them have changed their perspective on terrorism since 9/11. If they continue to say to the people of Western Europe, you know, we have to find ways of combating genuine terrorist threat, and at the same time want to choose a fuel source for one form of generating one small component of electricity that could have, you know, disastrous security consequences, then I think we have a very strong argument to make against it for that, even using the logic of the governments. On the experiment, I think they did do it as an experiment, and I think they have done studies to measure how far that radioactive waste has been distributed in the Irish Sea, how far it's gone into the North East Atlantic, how far it's traveled around into the North Sea, how far it's contaminated the coastlines of Norway and Denmark, how far it's... I think they have done experiments. I think it was an experiment. I think it was an unbelievably cynical experiment. I don't think it was purely to get rid of the waste. It was convenient for them that they could discharge it without any regulatory control because there were no organizations like Greenpeace in the 1950s to challenge them. But I also do think they tried to find out what the implications were. And the other thing I would say, which I didn't mention at the beginning, is I think some of those experiments they did on workers and some of the experiments they did on workers' families wasn't done because they wanted to improve the radiation protection standards for the workforce. I think they did it for military reasons, just like they did in the U.S. And I think that they deliberately irradiated parts of their workforce to see what the consequences were. And I think hopefully they now end up paying very large compensations to the grandchildren of those people for having deliberately exposed them to radiation in secret experiments in the 1960s. I hope that's the consequence. And I think that in Britain, if we can have a strong political fight to open up all of the reports that are lodged in our national archives, I think there's going to be a very big court case and hopefully a very big compensation. You can't bring back the lives of the workers, but at least you can do is to demonstrate there's some recompense to their families two generations later.
Okay.
Thank you.
Shall I? Oh.
Yes. Yeah. Hi. I just have one question about the TORP facility. At the TORP facility, you are preparing the MOX fuel, yes? And also making the separation of the plutonium from the materials coming in. So today, consequently, there is no production in Sellafield or MOX fuel.
Are you asking me, is there?
Yes. Is it any production of MOX fuel in Sellafield today?
Yeah, there is, but it's not on a commercial scale.
But the TORP facility, it's completely closed today, yes?
Yeah.
But this says on the homepage or be an FG, that it has completed the environmental approval for reopening as early as in January this year. Do you know that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we all should hold a healthy skepticism for anything written on the homepage of British Nuclear Group or British Nuclear Fuels or any of their nuclear industry. Yeah, they have, in their words, cleared the environmental hurdles, but they haven't yet reopened Thorpe. The Sellafield MOX plant doesn't have to have Thorpe operating to operate because it's already got separated plutonium by the tens of tons at Sellafield. But that doesn't operate either commercially because they can't make it work. So Thorpe isn't working at all. The Sellafield MOX plant is processing, but it's not in any kind of commercial way. They keep it operating so they can say it's working. So, you know, there's the real world and there's the BNFL fantasy world, I think, is the answer to your question.